This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Hi Artemis, Carly Kutnick here, and this week we're revisiting a 2021 episode on the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and more with Sarah Tingey. ANWR is 19.3 million acres of pristine Arctic habitat, and at the moment is the center of two conservation issues. The BLM's comment period for the Coastal Plain Draft Supplemental Environmental Impact Statement is open until November 7th. This document covers which lands will be offered for oil and gas leasing and what terms and conditions apply to those leases. The second issue is the BLM's Ambler Road Draft Supplemental Environmental Impact Statement. The proposed Ambler Road provides access to industrial miners and allows for exploration and development of mineral deposits in the Ambler Mining District. Learn more about these conservation issues and join Artemis and the National Wildlife Federation in providing comment to the BLM via the links in our show notes. Otherwise, I hope you enjoy another fantastic rerun hosted by Marsha and Ashley.
Artemis endeavors to get more women in the field and on the water.
To support women as leaders in the conservation movement.
To ensure the vitality of our lands, waters, and wildlife.
Artemis endeavors
to change the face of conservation.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Artemis Podcast. I am your host, Marsha Brownlee, and with me again today is Ashley Chance. Hi, Ashley.
Hey.
And our guest today is Sarah Tingey. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, how are you doing, you two?
I am doing great. I'm super excited to talk with you. Thanks for joining us today.
Yes, thanks for the invitation. I'm excited.
So Sarah, before we dig into some questions, I was going to ask Ashley for a Charlie update. Ashley, how's Charlie today? Charlie's her three-month-old baby?
I looked at the calendar today and she's 3.5 months old now.
Oh,
my daughter, yeah.
Yep.
Oh my gosh, that is awesome. How fun.
Yeah, she's something else. She's doing good. Update today. She's just still chubby and cute, basically.
Chubby and cute. Yeah. Charlie Chuck, she's still chubby and cute.
Ashley, is she your first child?
She is, yep. First
one. Oh man, congratulations. That's so fun.
Thank you.
Very cool. So Sarah, what's in your freezer?
What I have in my freezer right now, I've got a whole mix of things. I have some elk in my freezer. I have some local beef and pig from a family that farms right down the street from us. I think I have one piece of wild-caught Alaska salmon from a friend of mine that I went to college with who now fishes up in Alaska with her family, and I organize a fish bulk buy from them every year down here in Mancos. Nice. We're just about to get new fish for this year, so that's why I only have one piece left. I have a bunch of like frozen roasted tomatillos, a bunch of frozen coconut lentils for Waylon, who is my 18-month-old. Gosh, what else? Smoothie making supplies. I think that might be covering the majority of what I don't have a bunch of frozen beef bones for making bone broth.
That sounds awesome. I was going to come back to the one piece of salmon left in your freezer because that would like be fought over in my family.
Waylon's going to get it. Like
Waylon's going to get it.
Yeah. Ashley probably already understands this concept. And Marcy, do you have children?
I do not.
You know, okay, you can probably imagine too, but all of a sudden you're like, oh no, of course I'm going to give my last piece of salmon to Waylon. Waylon loves salmon. It's like not even a question anymore. So eliminates a lot of that, like, sort of partner to partner squabbling over last goodies when you're like, oh, of course, let's give it to this little human.
As long as your partner feels that way too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I feel like as soon as either one of us plays the card of like, well, Waylon wanted it, you're like, oh, well, shoot. Even if you did really want it, you can't argue with that. You just feel like a jerk. You're like, that's awesome. The toddler wanted it? Okay.
Too bad. That's awesome. Yep. Okay, so let's dive right in. Tell us a little bit about who you are.
Currently, I spend the majority of my time at Alpaca Raft when we're located in Mancos, Colorado, where I do a little bit of everything. I feel like technically my title might be operations director, which I think we had to come up with for some sort of bank application at some point. I don't even know, because it's not very representative of what I do. Like, on a day-to-day basis, it can be anything from looking for boats or other items for donation requests or fundraising events that are coming up, to helping staff with any variety of hiccups or challenges that have come up that are keeping them from doing their job, to helping research and create like new benefits for our staff, to assembling furniture for people, to coordinating with cleaners. It really is pretty wide-ranging job. Yeah, so I don't know. Maybe I'm like sort of like a Jill of all office-y type trades around Alpaca, but I'm also a mom and a wife and a sister, and maybe you've called me a hunter angler.
So I do have a lot of follow-up questions that sparked my curiosity. And one is, so you have Waylon. How old is Waylon?
Yep. Waylon is 18 months.
18 months.
Yeah.
How's that going?
He's going great. Actually, you know what? I think he's 19 months now. Ooh. Losing track of the time all of a sudden. He's great. It's a really fun age. I feel like this might be my favorite age so far, because he just started walking and he's such a little character. He's so curious and he likes being outside, and he has a rock collection that he's formed outside our front door. And I mean, he's just a hoot on a day-to-day basis. It is so fun to see what he gets into and what he's interested in doing. So he's a real highlight.
Now I have the problem of picking the next question and where I want to start. Let's start with Alpaca Raft. So I guess give us an overview of what an Alpaca Raft is and how you got started in rafting. Let's start there.
Sure. So at Alpaca Raft, in a nutshell, what we do is we build pack rafts, which are like small inflatable boats for backcountry travel. Now, in recent years, we've seen a lot of people using them in the front country and side country as well. But initially, like way back in the day when we first started building them in like 2000, it was for a sort of a niche group of folks that were using them in the deep backcountry. And certainly, I want to be clear that like Alpaca did not invent the concept of pack rafting. Sometimes I hear that attributed to us, which is absolutely not the case. But what we did do, I think, was modernize the concept and bring it to a place where it is accessible to more and more people. So really the founding of the company probably even started back in like the late 90s. My husband, Thor, did like a 700-mile trip across the Brooks Range. And there was, you know, other trips that led up to that trip. But that ultimate trip, he took what was available on the market at the time, which was an inflatable, and it was technically a boat, but not super seaworthy, not really designed to do the type of trip that Thor and his tripmates like put that boat through. And they spent a lot of time repairing boats on the side of the river, a lot of time right on the edge of like hypothermia while they were paddling. And when he got back, he's like, man, I love this concept of landscape travel and connecting rivers that are on the maps together via overland travel and being able to carry my boat equipment with me. But this tool is not going to work. Like this, I need a better boat. And he came home and talked with his mom, Sherry, about that. Sherry has a long history in the outdoor industry and outdoor design. She's owned a couple of her own companies doing design, anything from like dog mushing suits to she's designed for a few other outdoor companies to she's done mountaineering suits. So she was able to take sort of that wealth of design and sewing background, and she just needed to tweak with it to turn it into something three-dimensional and like inflatable three-dimensional, you know? And so that's kind of how they got started. And it was originally building boats for, you know, Thor and his friends and then people that they knew in the community. And Thor and I met in 2001, right when things were still very like garage level. And I sewed inflation bags and stuff sacks on my mom's quilting machine in our basement in Anchorage. And I don't think any of us ever thought that it was going to be full-time work for us, let alone, you know, the 45 people we now have here that are working day in and day out building boats for people around the globe.
Yeah, that's cool. And I didn't know that Sherry had that kind of design experience. I mean,
she does. Yeah, that's super cool. She's so fascinating. Like, she has such a long history. She used to, have you ever seen like one of those old like Warren Miller ski films?
Yes.
Inevitably there'll be someone in there that has this crazy ski suit on with like design and applique and crazy colors. Like, chances that that could be one of Sherry's suits is not unreasonable. She sold her like custom ski wear. It's called Design by Sherry in like Alta and Aspen. I think she had like one or two other shops, and she just designed custom ski suits with these crazy patterns all over them for people. That's how she got started.
Where did you grow up? You mentioned living in Anchorage. Is that where you are from?
Yes. I was born and raised in Anchorage.
Very cool. And wow. So to go from Anchorage to Southern Colorado, that's a big shift.
It is a big shift. It is very different. Like, I think my heart is definitely still up in Alaska. When I moved from Alaska to go to school, I never thought I wasn't going to go back. It's one of those things that you look back at as an adult and you're like, oh, life just sometimes takes you directions that you never saw coming. And it's not that you don't have a choice in the matter, but it's so funny. I look back and I'm like, oh, there's choice one, choice two, choice three. And in hindsight, you can see that each of those small choices was taking you farther away from the direction you thought you were going. But at the time, you don't see it that way. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's kind of how I feel about ending up in Southern Colorado, whereas like I was going down to finish a degree and I was going to be back up in Alaska in 2.5 years. Yeah. Like there was, and still I fantasize that someday I will live in Alaska again, that's not a forever gone part of my life. I just love it up there.
Did you ever read Choose Your Own Adventure books? Do you remember those? Yeah,
do remember those. I do. Yeah. And I remember them being like really stressful. It's funny you bring that up. I would not call myself a really great decision maker. I have to use some pretty firm self-talk to keep myself on the rails sometimes and not like spin out on the pros and cons of various things. So Choose Your Adventure books, I did read them, but I can remember even as a child getting kind of anxious about making the right choice, even though it's like a paperback that you can like go back and just do the other one if you want to.
Yeah, but I mean, there are consequences, right? Like, because what if that's not your favorite story, but that's the first one you read, and so now that's the one that's stuck with you.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
Ashley, did you read Choose Your Own Adventure books?
I did, and I wanted to read every single ending. Like, I didn't want any potential ending to be unknown.
Yep.
So I identify very much with that approach. And that's how I feel about life too. It's so funny hearing you talk about your plan of like, this is just a stop on the way and you're going to be back in Alaska, because that's very much how I thought about the Southeast. When I went to grad school in Mississippi, I was like, I'll just go do this quick and then I can be on the West or back North. And here I am in Tennessee with a baby shopping.
Yeah. It's really interesting to see where your life ends up and like what that balance is between having plans and then also being able to like kind of gracefully let go and let life redirect you a little bit without, I don't know, being so, I don't know, like connected to what you thought was going to happen, that you can't enjoy the direction you're going. Like, that's something I have to remind myself of sometimes, and being like, well, it's okay. Like, I know you thought you were going to go do this, but you know, this is
for sure.
Just different and unplanned does not mean bad.
No, it's the journey, not the destination.
Mm. Yeah, right.
What's your background as a hunter angler? Tell us about that.
Oh, well, growing up, I did mostly fishing, I would say. And I would still think of myself as more of an angler than a hunter. Say my dad hunted a lot every year. Gosh, at the risk of him listening to this and being upset, I'll say he never invited nor encouraged my sister and I to hunt growing up. But he has since we've been adults, which has been nice. So I'm trying to think. I think I went hunting for the first time in my early 20s. And I probably started with ptarmigan. Mm. When I met Thor, he had a lab and they would go hunt ptarmigan. And I went with them. And then he also hunted sheep. And so I went on a lot of sheep hunts, which I loved when we lived in Alaska. It's such a beautiful way to see the mountain terrain in that state. But never on my own tag. I just always went along to glass and spot for sheep and just pack out. And then
I don't know, maybe I'm wrong here, but I feel like hunting sheep in Alaska is probably not something people do alone very often.
No, I don't think probably. Well, what you mean, like alone, like solo?
Yeah.
We have one friend who hunts solo pretty frequently, but outside of that, I think you're right. I think people are usually at least in a group of two, if not, you know, three or four.
Yeah. So anyway, where did it go from there?
So when we moved, we were in the Pacific Northwest for a while, and then still I hunted like upland game birds there. Maybe once or twice a year, you know, chuckers and pheasants and quail. And then I can't remember my first time I went hunting with my dad for a large game animal. We went hunting for elk in northern New Mexico, and I shot a cow elk with a rifle, which was pretty exciting. That was actually really exciting. I had a great time on that trip.
It's just such cool land to hunt, and I imagine completely different from what you were familiar with in both Alaska and the Pacific Northwest.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And then we moved to, let's see here, when did we move here? In 2015 to Southwest Colorado, maybe 2016. And we've been hunting elk in our zone ever since. Unsuccessfully, although we've had great times out in the backcountry, we've been unsuccessful. Thor's shifted to archery and been learning a lot every season about hunting archery. And I was pulling muzzleloader tags because that overlaps the archery season here back up. But every year we learn a little something about like, oh, we should have done it this that way. Thor just got back from hunting. And he had a couple opportunities that he didn't take. And he's like, I'm just going to file that away in my Rolodex of information on what to do better next time. Yep. But I'm going back to northern New Mexico to hunt in, I guess, mid-October. For elk, because I think that's third rifle for them there, and I have a private land tag for somebody that my dad knows down there, so I'm excited and hopeful that will go well. My brother's coming down, my sister, so the three of us are going to go.
Oh, that'd be lovely.
Yeah.
Cool, yeah.
Yeah, well, let us know how it goes. Mm. We always like to hear post-hunt stories, regardless of what happens. like to hear post-hunt stories.
I'm just hoping that I get to hear one elk bugle. Like, honestly, if I get to hear an elk bugle when I'm out in the field, that is like enough. I'm like, oh, it's a successful trip. I just love, it's one of the most amazing things, I think.
I agree.
Yeah. And sitting in camp sort of at dusk or the early morning, yeah, listening to elk bugle. I'm like, I don't even care if I see one hardly. I just like listening to them.
Yep. Yeah, I think it's interesting because, I mean, listening to an elk bugle is something in and of its own. Like, there's something about that that can't be compared to anything. And I find that anytime I'm on a hunt, no matter what I'm hunting, as long as I see the species that I'm pursuing, it feels like a success, even if I don't harvest it. If I can lay eyes on it.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Even seeing a lot of sign of the animal, like sign that they've been there recently, to me is like pretty exciting and fun. But like, I just, you know, sometimes it feels like going hunting when you don't see anything, you're like, well, what's different about it than just going on a backpacking trip, you know, or something like that. And it still feels different to me, just the way you like interact with the landscape, how quiet you are, the amount of time that you're just still watching and listening and observing. It's just a totally different way of interacting with the outdoors than just going hiking or backpacking. And I like it.
Same here. You're just a part of the landscape and mm-hmm. attuned to it in a way that's hard to achieve when you're not in pursuit.
Yeah.
Yep.
So one of the reasons that you're here to talk to us today is mm-hmm. to help us get to know the Arctic Wildlife Refuge and the time spent in mm-hmm. that beautiful space. And so I would love to know, like, what is your experience in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge? And tell us about that. Like, what have you done there? How have you been there? But then I'm also hopeful that you can describe it for us and kind of paint a picture of it for those of us who haven't ever even been close to it.
Man, I went to the Arctic Refuge for the first time in 2015. And, you know, despite growing up in Alaska, I had never spent, I mean, I think the furthest north I'd been was Fairbanks. I did fly to Prudhoe Bay once, but that's an aside. You can just edit that out. That's no relevance to anything.
It's close to it. It's just to the west.
So for all intents and purposes, like, Fairbanks is as far north as I traveled when I was growing up there and lived there into my like early 20s. And when we flew into the Marsh Fork on the Canning, and it was so beautiful, I cried. Like, it is one of the most stunning and unique landscapes I've ever visited. And it was life-changing for me in a way that I got back from that trip, and all of a sudden, like, the conversations that were going on about oil development and protection of the refuge were relevant to me. Like, they resonated. I was like, oh, wait a second. This isn't just some place off the beaten path that like nobody cares about and doesn't have anything going on there. I was like, this place is stunning and so worthy of protecting for so many different reasons. And so I've gone back and done a trip there four or five times. I've been back a fair amount for my first time, just only having been in 2015. And they've all been pack rafting trips, you know, overland. Pack rafting, either just like fly in and float and get picked up, or most of them involve a fair amount of backpacking and overland travel as well. And two of those trips have crossed across the coastal plains, which are stunning in and of their own right. You know, you come out of the mountains, which are just spectacular, and into sort of the rolling foothills of the coastal plains. And you can hike up and get on these like just sort of like little mounds, ridges, and see for so far across the coastal plains. And the animals that are out there, the bird life that is out there, the flowers that you see out in the plains, like, it's all so spectacular. And so when people talk about it being a wasteland, it like almost makes me teary again. Talking about it right now, because it is just so far from that, just anything but.
Can you say, it's now on my bucket list Uh-huh. So, I mean, I think that's one of the, yeah, the number of places that have been added to my bucket list since starting this job and getting to talk to hunters and anglers across the country is just bonkers. But every time I talk to somebody about their experience in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge, they speak about it in emotional ways.
Yes.
And I'm curious if there's a way to put words to that for us, because especially given your experience in wild places, right? You've been in wild places before. You've been in nature before. So what is it about that place in particular that impacted you differently?
I think it might be the scale of the space is part of it. I feel like that's saying a lot also from growing up in Alaska, where like the scale of everything in Alaska feels big. And then this feels just staggeringly bigger. Like if you're flying in, you can get on a small flight and Coldfoot and be in your small plane for like 2.5 or 3 hours getting to where your drop off point is. And you're just flying across open mountainous like landscape. And it's pretty sobering to be like, I mean, you are far out there in a way that I have not experienced in other land, like wild landscapes that I've gone to. You know, I've been able to like fly in and get out and not see anybody in 20 minutes or 30 minutes, but not like 3 hours to fly out there. And that was a big part of the difference for me. And I also think that it is the knowledge that there are so few of those large landscapes left that are, I'm going to say, relatively undeveloped. I know that there are developments and pockets and certainly communities out there and evidence of man, but by and large, it is an undeveloped landscape. And there aren't many of those left on the globe of that scale. And I think part of it is that knowledge that it you know, requires vigilance and like protection and cooperation from a bunch of different parties to keep that landscape intact. That makes it so inspiring when you're there, because you know it's not necessarily a given that it's going to stay that way, even though you would like it to be.
It's so interesting. I was digging into this issue just to get a little bit deeper background for our conversation. And I think I think everybody should look on the map to actually get a visual image of where the Arctic Wildlife Refuge is. And, it's also referred to as the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. So if you're Googling it, you should probably Google that or Google ANWR. And it's in that north, that far top corner of Alaska,
yep, that borders Canada. Northeastern corner.
Yeah. And it was saying that there have been actions taken to protect parts of that area from development since 1943, which is like even more impressive when you consider that Alaska didn't even become a state until 1959. So there's been tension in that space for a long time about preservation and development. And I think especially on the coastal plain, it's been decades.
Yep.
And an actual decision about protecting that land or developing that land has just been kicked down the road for about 40 years now.
Yep. And there have been scares and then reprieves. You know, we just got another reprieve with the new administration coming in, who have like temporarily blocked development actions that were being taken there. Yeah. But that's not a permanent protection. So, you know, the battle fight's on. And like, I know, I can't remember now who said this, but you've heard like, in conservation, you only have to lose once. Like you get one loss. And when the development has happened, it's happened. And then you have, hundreds of years? Even if you were like, okay, we developed it, now nothing's happening there. Like how long for that landscape to like recover from that?
That landscape and that wildlife. And
And I, you know, one of the things that I think gets argued up there sometimes is, you know, people, I think, use imagery of the mountain range right there on the edge of the coastal plains to sort of advocate for the refuge. And opponents will say, well, that's not what's being developed. We're talking about this wasteland coastal plain area out here. Nobody even cares about that. And A, that's not true. People do care about it and utilize it. B, it's beautiful. But C, the other like big impact that doesn't get talked about is just what the impact of the viewscape out there would be, because the development that would happen out there is going to be visible for so many miles because there's nothing in the way of seeing it then. You know, and we talk to people at Alpaca, you know, every year who are buying boats, because they dream of going to the Arctic Refuge someday. We don't talk to that many people who are buying boats or dreaming about taking a trip in MPRA, which is the National Petroleum, I think it's the National Petroleum Reserve. I may have to look it up, but the National Petroleum Reserve Alaska, which is over on the west side of the Hall Road, and it's already been developed. Like, people aren't floating those rivers out to the coast nearly as frequently.
It doesn't sound as desirable of a destination just by the name.
Just the name alone.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And, you know, and that's a fact. I think people want to get out and recreate in areas where they don't see that evidence of development, by and large.
The most recent opportunity you had to raft in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge, you took Waylon, right?
We did. Yep.
Tell us about that.
Oh, gosh, that was so fun. We went with another family that we know who has a two-year-old. I guess he's more like 26, 27 months, but just over two. And we put together like a 10-day trip on what we thought we knew to be a mellow river up there, and thought we put together a mellow itinerary. and then didn't have nearly as much downtime as we thought we were going to have. And we were all just laughing at ourselves traveling with these toddlers in the backcountry, being like, what were we thinking? Like, of course, this wasn't as relaxing as we thought it was going to be. We had a pretty challenging weather forecast when we got up there that delayed half of us from getting in to the backcountry on the day that we thought we were going to get there. So just by means of like slow chopping into our trip, we lost time here and there. And then we ended up having a much more hustle trip than we thought. Our plan had been to go in and maybe float every other day and then spend the off days hiking and glassing for sheep up there. And instead, the water was super low where we got dropped off. We had to tow pack rafts full of all of our gear and toddlers down the river for like the first 12 miles. So it took us like 2 days to go 12 miles. And then we got hit by an epic storm that dumped a ton of rain on us, and the river we were on basically flash flooded. It went from, I don't know, there wasn't a gauge on the river we were on, but one drainage over, the river went from like 1600 CFS to 17,000 CFS in like 7 hours. And so we woke up in the middle of the night at this camp we were at, and we're like, oh my gosh, like, what is going on with the river? And by the next morning at 7, it had come up so high, just sort of exploding waves in front of our camp. It went from being this like crystal clear, beautiful Arctic river flowing to just explosive muddy water that had spilled over the banks and come all the way. Like, we had to move our tents up onto a tundra bench. And we ended up waiting that out for 3 nights there in that one camp before we were able to get back on the water and go. But you know what? The cool thing about being out there with kids is like, they don't know. Like, our toddlers, they were happy as clams. You know, they put them in their rain suit and they're crawling around in the tundra and working on their stick and rock collection and, you know, doing the things they're going to do. They don't know what's going on. So
yeah. How is your stress level?
How's it? You know, we did have for sure have a few moments where we were like, you know, like, what are we doing? And the other mom and I were chatting after the fact, and we were like, you know, the thing that kept this trip from being like awful and kept it like still fun is that we made some really good decisions when we needed to without going into like panic brain mode where we're just like, it's okay. Like we are okay right now. Like we're just going to hunker down here and see what happens. We have enough food. Like no one is injured right now. We literally just had to move our tents and are all still dry, safe and fed. And we're just going to wait it out and see what happens. You know, we're not going to be like, oh my gosh, we have to make miles. Let's put on this river in this like crazy flood stage water, you know? So the day that we did finally get on the river, we boated about an hour and we're like, this water is still moving way too fast. Like the river was moving about 9 miles an hour. And there was like a lot of sort of hole dodging. And we were all of us like, this is too fast to be on the water with toddlers like we have. And we ended up pulling over and the other mom and I got out and hiked it with the toddlers and the backpacks downstream for a while. Well, Thor and Paul waited out the river continuing to drop and they picked us up downstream a couple hours later. But we were like, yeah, you know, the fact that we like got out and hiked, we're all still safe again. Like there's nothing to be super stressed out about right now. Stressed out is continuing to try to like stay in the water when it's clearly not a good decision. Like if one of us drops a kid overboard or something, we'll never catch up with them again. Going 9 miles an hour. That's stressful. And then you're like, okay, I'll make a better decision. Okay.
Oof. Ashley, you ready to go?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I'm just like, yes, let's do this. Actually, I need to know. Okay. This is an aside and I don't want to take away from this story because I want to talk about the refuge as much as possible. But what backpack do you use? I'm trying to figure out how to wear this baby on my back during hunting season. And I need to know.
Well, what you this use. Hunting season. So you have a 3-month-old. Yeah.
So she's 3.5. And so it's going to be about 2.5 months until I can put her in like an honest carrier. But
right.
The flip side of this is that I lived in West Africa for 2 years and in a village, and there's babies on the back much sooner than that in just a piece of cloth.
I was going to say, have you tried like wearing her like in a wrap? Because that's what I did with Waylon, his fur. Well, actually, that's not true. I did a bunch of hiking with Waylon before he was like 8 months old, wrapped on my front. And that worked really well. Like I could wrap him and put him on my front and carry him just like snugged up because he couldn't hold his head up. And then I could still carry a backpack. I'm trying to think. I think Waylon was finally having like enough head control that we were like, okay, we can put you in a backpack maybe sometime around 6 months-ish, somewhere in there.
Yeah.
And we have an Osprey frame pack, which has been great for carrying him around, which I specifically hunted down. They used to make a higher volume one that I got so that we could take him backpacking and on overnights and be able to carry enough stuff in it to take him. So that's worked really well for us.
I've heard good things about the Osprey and I'm shopping for one now.
Yep. Nope. It's been a really great, comfortable pack that has carried his weight really nicely. I was sort of sad when he grew out of the front carrier, like the front carrier, being able to have him on the front so I could have that and my backpack on at the same time. But you only get that for a couple months.
I actually called Osprey this week and told them they need to make a camouflage version of that pack because I know so many other women that have used it hunting and it's like blue and red.
Yep. Where ours is red, I will say that you can get it dirty enough eventually that it is not as bright a red as it is right out of the box. Cause ours is looking pretty dingy in comparison. I was in a store the other day and I was like, oh, that's not what our pack looks like anymore.
That's funny.
That's a good hack. I'm using it.
Yeah. You just got to scrub some mud in it, Ashley.
That's cool. Blaze orange one or a camo one. I think there's
right?
Be a market for that.
Yeah. Blaze orange, I feel like you can get away with too.
I like the idea of having the baby on front and the pack on back. It balances out a little bit.
Oh, it works so well.
Not conducive to bow hunting though. And that's
not
what
conducive to
that's
bow
what
hunting.
I'm trying to do.
No. Yeah. Not conducive. Yeah, I was gonna say the other really nice thing, Ashley, about the Osprey is I feel like it sets down really well. Like it has a super stable base. So as long as you can get them kind of into the slope on a, you know, I mean, not, you don't want the backpack at an angle itself, but usually you can find kind of a flat spot that you can kick in, even if you're on like an angled slope a little bit. It's pretty stable. Like, it's great. Like, Waylon is now, I don't know, 28 pounds and has yet to be able to shake his way enough that he can knock the pack over. So,
wow, that is impressive. Yeah.
No, that's good.
We are not sponsored by Osprey, but maybe we
can. Yeah. I don't know. Never mind, though.
They want to break into the hunting market. Now's their chance. I had a question and I can't remember. So hunting with Waylon, like, is that like, okay. I think this is a bigger question about recreating with a toddler and a partner, right? Like, when do you take Waylon out hunting solo? And do the three of you go out together?
No, I do not take Waylon hunting solo by myself, but that's because I don't hunt solo.
Right.
Like, I am much more of a sort of a communal one other person hunting type person. We did take Waylon hunting last year when he was, I guess he would have been 8 or 9 months at that point. And we did like a lot of sort of glassing and looking for elk. I guess we never took Waylon hunting at like, you know, sunrise. we did more like late dusk, kind of looking around and scouting for elk. But this year, I think that would be a little bit harder. I think we might have just entered the phase of like, it's not really realistic to take him for the next, I would guess probably year or two. I mean, who knows what he'll be like next year, but like this year, he just wants to like, you know, crawl around and pick up sticks and does not want to be like held quietly in your lap, just looking around, you know, and he wants to ask you what everything is, that, you know, you can't communicate with him right now. Like, hey, I need you to be quiet. That's not.
Well, you can't. So, he's just not going to listen.
No, yeah, totally. Yeah. I can do it till I'm blue in the face, but like his comprehension of what I'm asking him to do is not there.
Yep.
So I think this is a year where Thor has done a lot of hunting on his own. I'll go hunting on my own later this fall. I think we're going to maybe try to get out and go like sort of backpack scouting for an overnight here in one of the next two weekends. But in terms of like, if we actually think one of us is like, if Thor really wants to go hunting with the bow, I don't think Waylon and I are going to come along with him if he's actually doing that. Cause he's not a cooperative trip partner in that sense.
It's so interesting to me how they are until they're not, and then they will be again.
Right? And they will be like, again. Then there becomes some time, probably I'm guessing in the 3 to 4 range, where you can like chat with them and they reason with them just enough.
For the exact right period of time, right? Like for an hour.
To be able to go and like, is it going to be the same? No, it's going to be completely different than if you were out there on your own, but you can do just enough that they can get a sense of it. And maybe you go for 45 minutes from the car and that's as long as it lasts. Yep. And that's just like, okay. I think we're now in the year to year two before that's happens again.
So I've been thinking a little bit about this lately, and I would love your insight because obviously you're not afraid of getting out there and after it with the kid, and neither is Thor. And it's like you're talking about your experience with your dad, and mine was very similar. Like he hunted, but didn't take me with him when I was a kid, and I never asked either when I was a kid.
No, so it didn't occur to me.
Exactly. Like,
it wasn't ever even something that was on offer to the point that it would have occurred to me to ask if I could go.
Yep. And like, it just wasn't in our awareness that it was a possibility on either side. And I think there was a shift in that somewhere where it is in people's awareness. It is in dad's awareness. It's in daughter's awareness. It's in everybody's awareness that this is a possibility that can be presented. And so, you know, I hear awesome stories and have for a long time about dads who take their kids out hunting. Parents who take their kids out hunting together. But I'm thinking like one of the barriers of getting women engaged in outdoor recreation, which here includes hunting and fishing, is that they define leisure time differently. And I think especially for women who have children, like going out with the family on a family adventure, while fun and rewarding in so many ways, is not necessarily leisure for a lot of women. Because they're still, they're in charge of everything. And making sure everybody has the snacks that they need, everybody has the raincoat that they need, and things like that. And so I think my question is, that's a lot. That's a lot to plan for. It's a lot to carry. And how can partners best do that together so the burden doesn't fall on one person?
You know, I think there's like a lot that can be said around like how you split up that load so that one person isn't carrying it all. And even if you do have like that 50-50 split or, you know, 60-40 or whatever it is, being in the backcountry, with kids is not leisure time. I'll echo that. Like it's been interesting. Like we did this awesome trip with Waylon in the backcountry, and I came back more tired than I have ever been coming out of the backcountry. Like normally I go on like a backcountry trip and I am refreshed when I get out. Even if the days themselves are hard, it's like, you know, it gets dark at night and you're like, I'm just going to go to bed. You know, I'll put on like a book on tape or just go to sleep early, and I'm going to sleep way more hours than I ever do in the front country, because that's, you know, what there is to do. And I come out feeling great. And in the back country and with kids, I was like, just, you know, Waylon's going to do what Waylon's going to do and get up whenever. And you're like, oh, there's no like downtime, just reading your book with a cup of coffee, or, you know, reading your book in the tent, or just mellow chatting with other adults in an uninterrupted conversation for 2 hours in the middle of the day.
Totally.
Exactly. It is. So I just want to say, like, as we talk through, like, what can we do to make it easier to get out the door? Like, I don't want to paint this rosy picture of like, oh yeah, and it's going to be so relaxing and fun. Like, it is still, it's still tough. And I think like, I don't know, I feel like it's important to acknowledge that. Cause I also run into people who, you know, feel like they see other people that are like getting out there and doing it and thinking that there's not, like, it's not hard, or that they're not tired. And then they feel badly about the fact that they're feeling like it's hard and they're tired. And I'm like, no, I think you just realize that it's going to feel hard and you're going to be tired, but you want to go anyways.
Right.
Like, even if you figure out how to split the work up.
Yeah. Like say more about that though. Like I imagine there are a lot of answers to this question, but why do you want to go anyways?
Because I love being outside, and it makes me feel alive and like the version of myself that I like the best being outdoors. And I want to share that with Waylon and give him the opportunity to experience the outdoors like that. I think where Thor and I also often have the most fun together is outside in the backcountry. And I don't want to give that up, even if it's, you know, sort of like a bigger lift to get out the door. So I don't know, how can you split things up? Thor and I have a pretty natural split in what we'll get ready heading out onto a trip. Thor is much more on the prepping of like the hard gear and getting all of that packed, and I tend to do more like the food prep and things, which ends up being a good split, I think.
Ashley, are you burning up with questions?
For another time, certainly, because I have so many of them, but I just want to say thank you for being so honest about, I just love the way you said it. Like, it may be exhausting and maybe even sometimes not fun, but it makes you feel alive, and that's why you do it.
Yeah.
And I think that's important.
I'll give you guys an example because I think it can also be really easy to be like, oh yeah, I get outside with my toddler. We have a great time. It's awesome. And it sounds like it's all unicorns and ponies and I just am motivated and make it happen, which is not the case. Like, this past weekend, Thor was out elk hunting for like 6 days, and it was the holiday weekend, and I really wanted to go camping with Waylon. And at first it started out with, I was going to get out backpacking and I thought I could do it. And I had a friend that was going to help me. And then as the weekend progressed, I like could not figure out how to get myself packed with a toddler and two dogs to get into the backcountry, even like 2 miles. I was like, how am I going to carry all of this? And at one point I finally was like, okay, maybe I'll just go car camping. And I still was just, I ended up in tears sitting at the house in the afternoon, being just like completely overwhelmed with how to get myself and this toddler and two dogs like out the door. And I was like, maybe I just won't go. And I'm like, no. I'm like, Sarah, you can do this. Like, just like, let's just think through like what you actually need just to go car camping. But it was kind of, I don't know. I feel like sometimes the lift, even just to go do like a small thing outdoors, can feel insurmountable, even to people who are like motivated to get out there. And like, that's just the reality of it. I don't know. And we did. We ended up getting out there and going for a night. Waylon, like WWF, slammed the Thermarest as soon as I put it together and popped it. And I ended up having to like phone a friend who was like, yep, I have a Paco pad you could sleep on. I'll bring it to you. And I was just like, oh my gosh. We went and we had fun.
How did you end up working carrying a toddler and a tent and food and water and all that?
This weekend when I went by myself, or just how have we done it in the past?
This weekend when you went by yourself.
Oh yeah. Well, this weekend when I went by myself, this is how I ended up like bailing into just car camping. So I didn't really carry my gear anywhere. We just like rolled up and I pulled it out to, you know, this like kind of like open spot and set up tent. But you know, it's like setting up tent takes her because you're like, oh gosh, don't crawl into that. Wait, where did the baby go? It's amazing once they start moving, Ashley, and you can't like set them down and then they're still there when you come back to the same place. They start moving. And you're like, wait a second. I don't understand how you could disappear so quickly. Because they do. You're like, you were just there playing with this like stick and you turn around and you're like, they're gone. And you're like, where did you go? Goodness. You set up the tent in like 10 different steps separated by like 10 minutes a piece. You're like, oh, that took 2 hours to put the tent up. Cool.
One of the things that this brings to mind, I've been exploring lately as I Google my way through learning how to be a parent, is this idea of like, you know, what babies and kids evolve to need and then what they're actually provided with in our society today, oftentimes very different. And the concept of a village or a small tribe where really it's not just you raising your baby. There's, you know, multiple laps to bounce the baby, and there's multiple eyes to watch a toddler, mm-hmm. you know, when you turn around for a second. And
yeah,
it's kind of crazy that now it's up to one or two people 24/7 to do this job that really used to be shared among a lot of other people and a lot of people with a lot more experience.
Yeah.
In the case of, you know, aunties and grandmothers and grandfathers and whatever. So I think I just love how much grace you're giving yourself and by extension, everyone listening to this. And I'm trying to tap into that in my own way. I don't know where I'm going with this, but that just reminds me of that.
It is so easy to be so hard on yourself, Ashley. I am so good at it. Like, as well, being like, you know, why can't I do this? Why can't I, you know, make it out the door in like an hour with all of this stuff like I used to? And just like giving yourself permission to be like, it's going to look different. And like, you're still sort of getting out there and making the lift. And if you can find other people or families that are interested in doing the same thing, which I will say is hard. We only knew one other set of parents who even thought the idea of hunting with their kid was semi-reasonable, and they just moved to Alaska. So,
of course.
Which is Emily, right? Course. Is that Emily?
Yeah. Yeah, it's Emily. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. That's, for our listeners, that's Emily Liedergerber, who talked with this podcast about hunting while pregnant last year. Yeah. Now she's in Alaska.
Now she's in Alaska with her awesome, awesome little guy. And so there's some solo hunting up there and we'll do some solo hunting down here. But it is helpful if you can find someone else or another family who's interested in going with you and is open to moving at the adjusted pace that you need to go. It's huge because you get that second set of eyes and you get that other hand or just somebody who can, you know, hold and entertain and distract like the littles for just long enough that you can complete you know, something in a normal span of time is pretty awesome. But I don't know. It's like, yeah, it can be so easy to look around and only see like all the balls that you're dropping and everything that you're not doing well. And sometimes just to take like that breath and be like, no, it's okay. I'm doing the best I can given like the responsibilities on my plate and like the resources I have available to me right now. Like most of the time that is true for people. Like they're doing the best they can. And it's going to look different from week to week.
Hour to hour.
Yeah, hour totally. To hour, yeah. Yep.
Nice. Ashley, any other questions?
No, I'm good for now. That was great. Cool.
Then, Sarah, I would love to hear a story of one of your favorite moments in the field or on the water.
Oh, we did a trip in Alaska three years ago, I think. And we connected those four river drainages via a lot of overland hiking. I think we went about 185 miles. But the last day we were in the field, we got into some fresh run like Chinooks coming in that we were able to fish for on flies. And it was some of the most fun fishing I have ever done. I think one of the photos I sent you is of that day of fishing. And it is one of my like strongest, happy, fun fishing in the backcountry memories.
Sounds amazing.
It was great. Was that, there were just so was many fish. So impressive. What's that? No, it wasn't actually. It was not in that particular trip, was not in the refuge. Although there's some fun fishing. Grayling fishing is fun up there. The char fishing when they come in is fun. There's really fun fishing in the refuge as well.
So I'm going to transition us a little bit to talk about our hits and misses. But before I do that, is there anything else you wanted to talk about that we haven't touched on yet?
No, I can't think of anything right off the top of my head. Do you guys have anything?
Oh, I have a million things. I guess that would last an hour and a half longer. So I'll hold them for another time.
All right. Well, ping me anytime.
Okay. Ashley, how about you?
I identify with you, Marcia.
And I hear Charlie in the background. She got one. Or is that Waylon?
No, no, it'd be Charlie.
Yeah.
I'm trying to mute myself as well.
Don't worry about that.
Oh, my only request, Ashley, you have to send a picture of Charlie over. I'll swap you for one of Waylon.
Will do. I've got plenty of them.
I know. Isn't it amazing? All of a sudden you're like, I'm not going to be one of those parents whose phone is only filled with photos of my child. And then you're like, oh.
Yes, no, I am.
Just kidding.
I mean, how many pictures really... did you have of your dog before you got a kid? And then just like amplify that by a million, right?
Yep. That's about the right algorithm.
Yes, that is exactly the math behind that. Oh, and then sometimes you get dog and baby photos. Those are the best ones.
I have a hard time keeping them both still together, like a non-blurry photo. I will say that I had way more photos, like good photos of Waylon before he really started moving. Now I'm like, I have all of these ones where his facial expression is caught like mid-blink and stuff. I'm like, oh, getting harder and harder.
You were cuter when you were still.
Exactly. Potted plant phase, man. Soak it up.
That's noted.
All right, we're going to take a quick break to hear from our NWF Outdoors podcast partners. And speaking of the NWF Outdoors podcast, if you've been hearing a lot about things called infrastructure and reconciliation coming out of DC recently, and you want to dig into a little bit more what the heck that means and why it's really, really important for conservation, you should check out the most recent NWF Outdoors podcast where they have a conversation with Abby Tinsley and go into the specifics of, you know, what the heck that is. But we will be right back.
Howdy, Artemis listeners. This is Aaron Kindle from NWF Outdoors. We know you love awesome conservation conversations. That's why we want to invite you to check out the NWF Outdoors podcast, where we dive deep into the issues, people, and places that showcase the best of the sporting conservation lifestyle. Guests include leaders, luminaries, and decision makers who define conservation and work tirelessly for fish and wildlife. Check it out wherever you get your podcasts or at nwfoutdoors.org.
All right, welcome back. Let's go ahead and dive into hits and misses. So, Sarah, this is our weekly closer. And the question is, what have you been aiming for and how did it go? And Ashley, why don't you go ahead and kick us off and I always like to give the guests a little bit of a preview of what I mean when I ask this question. So I put our co-host in the spotlight first.
So I have a big miss for this week. We are trying to buy a house and it's not going well. Right now we're on the verge of buying a few acres in a camper. I would consider that a hit, but for now it's a miss.
Well, when you get the few acres in the camper, let me know.
Oh, you'll know.
I feel for anybody who's trying to buy a house right now. It just seems like across the country, it's a challenging thing to do.
Yeah, they keep saying it's going to change, but the inflection point has not been reached yet.
Do they tell you when it's going to change?
No.
Okay. Well, good luck. Keep us posted.
Thanks.
Yeah. Sarah, what have you been aiming for lately and how did it go?
Man, I feel like I should have thought about this before I just told that story about trying to aim to get out backpacking with my toddler. Because that's really the hit miss of this weekend was, let me think if I can think of something else. So I think that was the big one, which I was all geared up and had all this momentum to try to get out the door and do like a really wee short, like 2 mile backpacking trip with the toddler and two dogs by myself. And I just couldn't make it happen. But we ended up car camping and doing 2 day hikes instead and had a lovely time. But it wasn't what I had built up in my head.
I feel like this circles back nicely to our choose your own adventures segue earlier in the podcast. We're like, you chose an adventure, you decided it wasn't for you, you went back, and you chose another adventure. But you chose an adventure, even if it looked different.
Yes, that is true.
It's a hit. I can't decide if it's a hit or miss yet, and it's in progress, so I'll keep you posted. But I've been doing an elimination diet because I think I have some food allergies or sensitivities that I kind of want to identify and figure out what they were. Have either of you ever done an elimination diet?
Oh, no, the doctors told me to do it before and I'm like, not for me.
Sarah?
I have done a diet where I cut a lot of things out. I don't know if it's a true elimination diet. I did it for about 30 days and then slowly started reintroducing things in. It's challenging.
I was so surprised at I'm not super far in. I'm honestly like a week in right now, but my thinking capacity like dropped to the floor in the first few days as my body was just trying to adjust to what I was feeding it now. I was like constantly hungry. I couldn't think clearly. It was overwhelming and surprising.
Yeah, it was eye-opening for me, like what a rut I was in with my eating. And it wasn't necessarily a bad rut. I wasn't eating bad things. I just was like, I have my known go-tos that I know how to prepare and that work for me and are easy for me to get out the door. And when all of a sudden I had to really rethink what was going into those or how I was putting things together, it was a huge brain lift. And I was like, oh.
Yeah. So I feel like I'm finally coming out of it and I'll keep you guys posted because it's going to be for a while. But so to everybody at all connected with me and Artemis, if you see some weird things coming out, it's because I'm on an elimination diet.
Give Marcia a little bit of grace.
Marcia only has oatmeal and bananas to eat, so give her a break.
Not even the oatmeal, man. I've got bacon and bananas, which is
that's good.
Not a bad thing to have. I mean, I'm not struggling with the kind and quality of food that I'm eating. It's just different than what I usually eat.
Oh.
Anyway, on that note, Sarah, thanks so much. This was fun. I enjoyed talking with you. And I'm so grateful for your conversation and your time.
Oh, thanks you guys for reaching out. This has been fun talking with both of you as well.
And
thank you, Sarah.
Yeah, reach out anytime if you have anything follow up for sure.
Yeah, you bet. Absolutely. We could probably start a series about backcountry
with backcountry kids. Babies.
Backcountry babies.
For sure.
All right. To our listeners, thanks for joining us on the Artemis podcast. We hope you're having a great week. Until next time, be bold, stay curious, and get outside.